So this is quite down to earth again, like Adrian's talk was a bit more. In the end, there will be two more exotic topics. So if you find it too boring, then in the end I will try to excite you a little bit more. Most of what I will be talking about in the first part is about experience at GEO with mostly two topics: thermal compensation, or in general problems we had increasing the laser power, and the other aspect is squeezing application. So the two things which are relevant for high frequency detectors here. Something that hasn't been mentioned, I will just briefly mention, is to talk about the light sources for future detectors. So I think we are all kind of assuming that we can have something like 500 watts. And I talked briefly to Benno Wilke from AEI, who is responsible for the LIGO lasers for the time being. And at least so for 1064, as many of you will know, there's a kind of a clear path. So there's a certain limit what you can do with the small resonant cavities, and so this basically gives the reason for the scheme as it is now. You have a small master oscillator and then an amplifier stage of 100 watt, but there's a limitation in that as well, which mostly comes from the heat you put in and from the power density. And so one other way to go is to fiber amplifiers which are more efficient. So beyond 100 watt, people research fiber amplifiers for 1064 at least. And so 300 watt fiber amplifiers do work right now, however, not long term. So it's a kind of risky business. Every now and then, if you have a very small increased absorption at some fiber end or so, you get a runaway heat entry and the thing blows up. And so this is for the time being unsolved, but people are confident that can be solved over the next years. And then the one idea on top of that is coherent beam combination. So to get to 500 watt, for example, you could combine two times 250 watts. That's at least a plausible path for 1064 right now. Okay, and with that, I come to power increase in GEO. So GEO, as you know, is the 600 meter interferometer in Germany. And the main difference to the larger detectors is that it has no arm cavities, which has an important consequence for the power distribution. So in GEO, all the power in the power recycling cavity is incident on the beam splitter. So for the time being, that's something like 2 to 3 kilowatts. So it's a bit more than LIGO has right now, and it's roughly the same level that advanced LIGO may have some time in the future. So that means we can study the beam splitter thermal lens and kind of the same power regime as LIGO for the time being. And before I come to the beam splitter, historically there have been several problems with power increase, and of course we can say they are more or less trivial to solve. If you think about a 20 years horizon or so, then these are kind of technical problems, but as many of you know, they can eat a lot of your commissioning time, and at least have to be taken into account in future designs. And one of them people who worked at interferometers are familiar with is, for example, saturations on photodiodes and on photodiode electronics. So as you increase the power, you have to make sure that you keep your dynamic range intact and your noise low while you increase the power, because typically you acquire log with some low power to have not so much radiation pressure, and then you increase by a factor of several 10 or maybe in the future even more to go from 1 watt input to 100 watt input. And so this also while you do this, changes the demand on the photodetector. So you want, in the beginning, the noise is not so important, but in the end, you want very low noise, and this leads already to switching between different photodetectors. But of course, in some future world, it's nice if this can be taken into account, maybe in a better way or so. And scattered light was a problem in GEO also in some trivial way, if you will, because the first limitation that we hit with increasing the power really was scattered light from the main interferometer at the main laser wavelengths at 1064 nanometer into the what we call shadow sensors or local control sensors, which damp and control the suspension. So we had a cycle of scattered light going into the suspension controller and giving false information. It looked like suspension motion, and then this excites more suspension motion and then more scattered light, and so it became quickly unstable. Of course, that's a design issue, so you have to make sure to put filters into your local controls and so on.
You say that's solved now?
Yeah, for GEO, well, we went to a modulation scheme, but with increased the noise a little bit. So
it's acceptable noise.
Yeah, for GEO, it's fine. And after we solved that in 2011, I felt like a great relief. Now the path is clear to increase the power, but it didn't happen really, because soon after we were hitting other limitations. So another thing that I think has been briefly mentioned before is some power instabilities due to clipping and radiation pressure. So that can be a kind of runaway cycle as well. I think it has been seen in LIGO as well. If you have some asymmetric clipping somewhere in the power cycling cavity, for example, and you have a small angular fluctuation that modulates this clipping, then you can get changing radiation pressure on optics, which increases the alignment, and you can get a runaway oscillation with this as well. And of course, that's also in some sense a technical problem, but it's an important one, because scattered light in general is a problem, and so there are now more and more sophisticated baffle designs, and so in principle you can also have more opportunities to clip beams depending on the design of those baffles. Hopefully less opportunity to clip beams, but it's a consideration. And the next limitation we were hitting, which essentially is the most important limitation today, is in fact thermal lensing at the beam splitter. So as I said, there are no arm cavities, and the beam splitter is the only component in GEO that sees the full power of the power cycling cavity in a transmitted optic. So the power cycling factor is pretty high. It's about 1,000. Okay, so and what we do at the beam splitter is we try to do thermal compensation, but first of all, this is the scheme. So the beam splitter folded arms just like in a single Michelson, and the power cycling and signal cycling mirror. So as I said, here we have between 2 and 3 kilowatts, and yeah, it was already mentioned by Aidan. Of course, thermal lenses have all sorts of bad consequences for spray light and control. As we will see in GEO, one dominant thing that you see is that the power at the dark port does not grow proportionally with the input power. It grows more than quadratically. So it's already in a regime where the contrast is much worse, and much more power in forms of higher order modes gets to the dark port. And that, yeah, as we said, has all sorts of consequences for the sensing and the noise at the output. One thing I thought earlier is, I don't know if you discuss this for the future. And it's an interesting that in the very early designs of GEO, there was a compensation plate foreseen here. So the idea is with that, you try to make the arms in the power recycling cavity symmetric in terms of substrate that the beam sees. So you can put compensation plate, which has the same shape and thickness as the beam splitter, in the north arm under the same angle, which means then that the beam in this arm sees the same substrate as the beam in this arm, and that to first order compensates your thermal length of the beam splitter quite well, provided that the substrates are equal, of course. So this is something I don't know if that's a consideration for the future, which can help in first order. I mean, there are already, as you know, compensation plates for the arm cavities, and so the idea would be to do the same for the beam splitter.
How do you make this kind of quadrupolar compensation plate? Because you have to do something, because the beam splitter lensing pattern is sort of complicated. So how do you put a compensation plate in one arm that fixes this differential?
It doesn't really fix it. It kind of does the same to the other arm. So you would put it pretty close to the existing beam splitter, assuming that it does the same to both arms. So you have the beam splitter substrate here, and I mean, normally there's not much curvature. The beam is almost flat there, so you can go a meter away and hang the beam splitter. And then the assumption is both arms see the same thing.
But that wouldn't fix the issue of the thermal lens picked up in the signal recycling cavity.
That doesn't fix what? For the signal recycling cavity?
Yeah, you still have a thermal lens in the beam splitter, which the signal recycling will see.
What exactly does the signal recycling cavity see? I mean, the signal recycling cavity sees only a thermal lens in the beam splitter where there is high power, but in the signal recycling path you don't have high power. Huh?
Oh, it's already, we actually drew it on the edge of the board there. So.
Oh yeah. Okay. So you only have high power here.
Yeah.
So you mean this part of the beam which overlaps with this, or what do you mean?
Yeah. I mean, make it small enough that you can neglect it, but you still have that sort of asymmetric lens.
Okay, but that might be significantly smaller than the other one.
So yeah. You assume that beam splitter has no distortion of the 50-50 surface, but it's not bent. Because I gather you were talking about the thermal refractive lens effect inside the bulk of the beam splitter, and not the curvature.
Yes, it's mostly about the absorption and the thermal lens in the substrate. Yeah, I mean, the bulge on the surface would be due to absorption. That would depend on how different is the absorption for the 50% reflective surface and the AR surface.
Yes.
I don't know. Is that very different? I mean, both are not HR surfaces.
But isn't the incident power is twice as high on the 50-50 surface?
Sure.
I'm just guessing. I've never really thought carefully about beam splitter.
Yeah. I don't know. It needs numbers for this to compare the coating with the substrate. Okay. And so what we do right now in GEO is try a thermal compensation scheme with many degrees of freedom, like with a pixel matrix, essentially. So as Aidan said, there's the idea that you can use CO2, of course, but the disadvantage of CO2 is, as you said, is the power noise. And so the idea here is that if you use thermal radiation, then you can you can get rid of the amplitude fluctuation, or at least you can filter them much better. So what this is supposed to be is a pixel array of little heater elements, which gets projected onto the beam splitter surface. And so you could put on thermal radiation in places where you want it and make some arbitrary compensation pattern. So what you see, these little dots here, these are PT100 resistive elements, and these angles here below are some reflectors which allow you to collect a little bit more of the or pi angle. You can do very important things with this. Of course, it would be nice if you had so much power here that you could project this kind of heat. So this is not the case. So we probably need more power in the future. This is more something like putting the heater element very close to this. But this gives you the idea what you can do with this. So the basic layout is there's an heater array and some projection optics to the viewport. So this thing is an air for the time being, and then that projects you an image onto the beam splitter. And yeah, as you also said, so the under 45 degrees, of course, the pattern of the beam is kind of elliptic. So you can try to match that with this heater array. This is a little initial experiment where Holger Wittel, who was working on this at GEO, modulated individually the power of each pixel, and then looking into the output response of the interferometer to see how each pixel maps onto the sensitivity at the output. So that gives you an kind of mapping where you can roughly see this elliptical shape of the sensitive region of the beam splitter, where the beam splitter is sensitive for heat input. Okay, and then this is a series of experiments actually trying to do some compensation of the thermal lens in the beam splitter. So the first more naive, if you will, ideas to use were to use some circular pattern similar to something you would do with a CO2 beam, for example, and then also, and then something with two dots, which kind of helps to compensate some astigmatism in the main beam, and then some other erratic pattern. So he tried linear combinations of this and found that some combination reduces the dark pod power by 22 to 30%. So it's kind of ongoing work, and the conclusion also was from this that more power is needed. And so in the meantime, there's a lens in the vacuum system. So it's kind of work in progress. So what is happening between this is the dark pod power here over time, so a bit over 20 milliwatts. And what is happening here is a power increase in the interferometer from 2.2 kilowatts to 3.5 kilowatts. And so you can already see that this is more than quadratic increase of the output power. And also, the whole interferometer becomes more stable. So these power fluctuations here are not normalized, but even the normalized power fluctuations are going up. And so at the moment, with this heater, so at best we can do this kind of reduction, which also then helps in the low power stage. We get some improvement, which means there's already some detrimental effect of this lens.
In the past, I remember looking at many, besides this one trace, we looked at these various things like the coupling of the laser oscillator phase noise to the dark core and the amplitude noise and these kinds of things, because they would tell you about these various things like the RF sideband imbalance and then the first Legarmo amplitudes and things like this.
Mm-hmm.
idea to look for better error signals or something?
Yeah, so far not really. I mean, something one could do is here use something like a face camera, like an RF error signal, which gives you some information. The dark spot, for example. The other noise couplings, yeah, might also be interesting. Well, at the moment, there's still an unsolved problem also that, for one thing, so it makes the interferometer more unstable, which we think comes from the much higher order mode output at the dark spot. But also there's some noise increase at the low frequencies, which is kind of not understood. So okay. So much for the thermal compensation. I mean, the thermal reflective noise was already mentioned. So that that of course increases if you lower the arm cavity thinness. I don't know if people know this Levin curve, which kind of and this one is a prediction for the geothermal reflective noise. So that's fluctuation of temperature making ddn over dt. Noise in the beam splitter, and you have this kind of simulation for the design for high frequency detector.
So what does it flat it out at, I don't know, about a kilohertz? Why it's flat?
I think it comes from the realization that there's a standing wave pattern in the beam splitter, which gives you kind of a permanent gradient, and then I don't know. Do you know the process? I don't.
No, because the geo one is a little bit special for the arm cavity case. We consider the thermal refractive noise in the two input mirrors. And in that case, it just keeps going lower to a lower level.
Yeah, but here...
No, this one, I don't know why it's
not. Yeah, I think the authors... I have to look it up again, but it's related to the to their realization that there's a standing wave pattern, which kind of increases the gradients. But I have to look that up again. This goes up to megahertz. So I don't know. It might be interesting to experimentally see if this is really true.
Normally in the glass, the temperature fluctuation at the high frequencies, there's no more temperature fluctuation, or the temperature fluctuation is there, but the wavelength, the coherence length of the temperature fluctuation is so short that it averages out over the beam size, and that's why the large beam always ends. But this seems to mean like the correlation is still there a little bit.
Because the wavelength is small, you have this steep gradients, which maybe make the coherence lens effect kind of different. Okay, and so Adrian gave a nice introduction to squeezing. So I'll just say a little bit about the implementation at GEO. We started with that in 2010. So here's the squeeze light source, still active today. There's also an evolution ongoing that today a kind of slightly improved squeezer with a better performance can be made on half the area. So it's under development, of course, as well. And so you inject squeezed vacuum into the dark port, and then that travels through the beam splitter into the interferometer and comes back and overlays with the output beam onto the photodetector. And what we did there is mostly to try to get this to the point that it can be long-term used, essentially all the time. So the first years, all the time we kind of worked on loss reduction, but in the first 2 years we concentrated a little bit more on the long-term performance, in the sense that we looked for better control signals and alignment control and so on to get to stable, reproducible conditions, because then it gets also a little bit more consistent if you look for losses. One thing we investigated here is different, as I said, different control signals. So the because the squeezed vacuum beam has not very many photons, the question is, of course, how do you generate a signal such that you can phase match it, phase lock it to the interferometer? And in the past, in the lab, what people had been doing is modulate the phase of the squeezed beam, for example, and then just watch the noise in the output of the interferometer and demodulate that. That's a technique called noise locking. And that is, of course, limited by its signal-to-noise ratio. So people came up with something else, and that is overlaying some proxy beam, some bright beam to the squeezed vacuum, which is at some other frequency. So that's several megahertz away. And you have to make sure that this, of course, has a stable phase relation to the squeezed vacuum. And then you send these two beams in and assume that your squeezed vacuum is kind of in the same phase and mode. And one of the constraints there is that then you, for example, have to use this RF beam also to generate a control signal. And in the beginning, this was done by beating this control side vent of the squeezer with the output of the interferometer beam, for example, at these pick-off ports. But it turns out that this is not a very good idea, because it also beats with the higher order modes, and then you can get false signals. So what we tried at GEO and implemented is the idea to use the transmitted beam at the output mode cleaner, which gets rid of the higher order modes, and also you can detect the full power of the carrier, and you, of course, lose something from the sidebands, which may get reflected at the output mode cleaner. So you have to choose your sideband frequency such that you don't lose too much, and so on. So there are several technical constraints. But the basic idea behind this is also to get rid of any part where you lose light due to pick-off mirrors. Because in the future, if you want to go to 10 and more dB and so on, you cannot allow for any significant amount to be taken out of your dark pod beam. So ideally, you do everything on the main beam. And this is also true for the alignment, for example. So for the alignment, first we used something like using the higher order modes transmitted here, but it turns out you can also use the beam reflected from the output mode cleaner, which has the advantage again that you use only light which is not needed for the main detection, but you don't need to take it away from the main interferometer. So there the kind of control ideas go together with the goal of reducing the losses as well. Okay, and that's just some shows how this OMC transmitted signal leads to more stable squeezing than the traditionally used pick-off signal, and something similar for the alignment. So that was quite successful after a while. So after two or three years, we had squeezing for most of the time when we wanted it. So whenever GEO was in science mode, it could operate close to 90% using squeezing as well. And there the squeezing is also fully automated. So it's a new subsystem, of course, of the main interferometer. It still needs more maintenance than the laser does, of course, because the laser is much more a mainstream product, which has been engineered much better, much longer. So it like looking at lab book entries about maintenance, it's, for example, I would say the squeezer needs factor 5 more more care than the laser does. And this is not going to change too quickly because there's no big commercial market, of course. So we are the ones who make the squeezers more reliable, because we are pretty much the only ones who want to use squeezing around the clock. So we still have to make them engineering-wise a bit more reliable. But pretty much this picture says this is possible. And so this is a histogram of the performance in the sense of how much squeezing is observed at the interferometer. So the observed squeezing level is here on the x axis up to 4.5 dB, and so each of these histograms covers 1 year of operation in terms of the full amount of time in terms of days. So each bin is a number of days how much Geo was operating at which squeezing level, and so that's a pretty good picture to show the kind of steady but slow progress, but also not always so steady. So yeah, sometimes there are improvements and then it goes a little bit back. And if you look closely, you will see that, for example, the kind of best year was 2016, and that's in fact this bump out here up to 4.4 dB. Whereas 2017, it went back to 3.5 dB, so which is pretty well understood, but it just means that it's difficult to keep a level if you continue to work on the system. So what was happening is that the limit here was realized to be the Faraday isolator, and the not only the isolator loss but also the way the polarization is controlled around the Faraday. So it was decided to make a new assembly, and the old one was taken out and replaced with a less good one, and that led to this lower performance, for example. So right now it just has been put in. So the kind of more near-term goal, people think they can reach 5 dBs within half a year or something like this, but this is it is kind of tedious work. So, and it's how representative it is difficult to say, because it's a small team and other things have been going on. So you can say we could have put in more effort in this, and then yeah, probably it's fair to say the progress maybe could have been faster by a factor of two or so. But it's I think it's hard to extrapolate this, but it's sort of steady but slow going.
How much of that was there any noticeable increase in squeezing level with the beam splitter wave meshing heater? Or I mean, it seems like a relatively small change in the total. It seems like a relatively small change in the signal coming out. Did you notice any change in the squeezing level with that?
No, not very significant. I mean, yeah, because it's only 60% more power. Of course, we see the shot noise benefit, but the squeezing level at least is not affected as it should be. So at least there was no apparent inconsistency, I would say. Yeah, so that's the spectrum with the current best, roughly. So yeah, I would agree. I think mostly I would agree that 10 dB seems not implausible for a time scale of, I don't know, 5 to 10 years, maybe something like this. Beyond that, I don't know. I think it's we can discuss again in 5 years or so, maybe. Yeah, this loss budget is not anything magic. I think more the more interesting most recent finding is that polarization is important. So one of the improvements from 3.5 to 4.4 dB came from improving a little bit more the mode matching and but which was not so bad in the first place. At Geo, it typically used to be around 95% to the output mode cleaner, so not totally terrible. But also the polarization, it turned out that it was beneficial. It's beneficial to have a lambda half plate and a lambda quarter plate in the beam parts, so to optimize the polarization.
The ejection as well as the regal.
So it's now in the in the pass between the Faraday and the interferometer. In the injection as well, but also in the path between interferometer and in the output mode cleaner, there's one too, because you have to rotate back the rotation that comes from the Faraday, but there's no lambda quarter, I think. I don't know, maybe
so
that.
It's like interferometer, lambda quarter, Faraday points.
Yeah. Okay, so yeah, this is just some work from the mode matching. So the way we used to do the mode matching is with the scan. This is a scan of the output mode cleaner with the interferometer locked. And you can see the carrier mode here with DC offset and the Michelson controlled sidebands. And what we used to do is to optimize the mode matching of the interferometer to the output mode cleaner by minimizing this peak here, which you cannot see here anymore because the mode matching is so good. So this first means that's the Hermite-Gauss 110 mode of the main beam, and it also has the sidebands. So we used to match the sidebands because the sidebands in GEO are the most perfect TM00 modes. And this is a scan of the squeezing bright beam, so you can operate the squeezer in a bright mode and then use it to reflect it off the interferometer and optimize the squeezing there. And so, yeah, this is the kind of mode mismatch, for example, you see here, which is of the order percent or 2%.
So this quarter wave plate thing, you have these two quarter wave plates, one in the squeezing injection path and one in this outward path. It seems like some tuning degeneracy. So you have to have some procedure to tune the angles.
Yeah. And I haven't done it myself, but yeah, sure. But you can do it for the injection beam and for the main interferometer beam.
Well, the idea is to match polarization of main beam and injection beam. Or there is something else.
Yeah.
And of course, you have to match. I guess basically, if the Faraday rotator is giving you non 45 degrees, if the Faraday rotator gives you a little bit of elliptical polarization and you want to recircularize, mm-hmm. or else the half wave plate doesn't do everything for you. It's the Jones matrix.
Okay, and another. Technical thing that we improved is to increase the dynamic range. I mean, we have been. It's already a few years old. This work kind of, but increasing the dynamic range of the DC readout photodetector. So, and it was important to also at the squeezing. It gets more important because if you squeeze, you come closer with your noise to the dark noise of the photodetector. And so, improving the readout noise. Already improved the squeezing when we did it, and of course that it's important to keep the dynamic range large at the output. So this is a new Faraday setup which has now photodiodes also to read out the position and power of the rejected beams at the beam splitters in the vacuum, such that you. Such that there's information about how much, which can be used for the tuning of the lambda plates. Okay, and I don't know. This is not. This has been discussed often, like future loss budgets. And for GEO, it's totally plausible to reach 6 dB. We think that was always the goal, and that's still still plausible. And 10 dB is a little bit harder, mostly depends then on these polarization effects and the Faradays, for example. But Faradays are improving.
But so far, why looks like 7%?
I think this is the kind of older design. I think with the new squeezer, it's at 2% or something like this.
Okay.
Yeah.
So this come from the anti-reflection coating in the crystal, or this?
Yeah, I don't remember that. What I'm using that. Okay. Yeah, that's it so far. So now two slightly exotic topics, and one is co-located interferometers, and I don't know if this is interesting for the future in terms of gravitational waves. I just stumbled upon it in context with a holometer. So if you have two Michelson interferometers close to each other, then of course this is a special question, of course, which I don't want to discuss in this talk, but the arrangement, if you have two interferometers, then you can use them for looking for correlated noise, and that was the original idea of the holometer experiment. But of course it's the same idea to look for stochastic background signal, and there's a paper that claims that if you have co-located interferometers, then of course we understand now and know that we can improve the quantum noise of them if we inject squeezing. And of course you can do that to both co-located interferometers independently, and then you lower their shot noise independently. However, there's a claim that if you use an entangled if you entangle the two squeezing inputs, then you can win more than in cases where you look for correlated noise in the output, because then this entanglement also gives you sort of a correlation of the quantum noise in the output. And so if you correlate that again, because you look for correlated noise, you get more quantum noise suppression. However, what I don't understand yet, or what I want to understand better, is whether this is at all feasible in terms of losses or not. Like, can it be really useful for us or not? There's a follow-up paper 2 years later where they claim, yeah, it's even with losses, it's still feasible. So the basic statement here is that if you have no losses, which of course is always very difficult, but if you have no losses, you can get completely rid of quantum noise in the correlated output. Maybe that's not so surprising, because if we think about 30 dB with no losses, then you can also say we can get completely rid of quantum noise, or almost completely. So I still want to understand whether there's a regime of loss where this technique can be really interested. And so this is why I brought up the question, maybe how interesting is the stochastic background at high frequency, and maybe it's too hard anyway. And the other two things I picked up, which I really don't know almost anything about, which I find interesting, of course, in the context with gravitational wave detectors. There's a paper on the archive from February. People thinking about how gravitational wave detector-like setups could be used for axion detection. You may know that, of course, axions couple to light, and there are some standard or some experiments that try to generate axions and then detect them. For example, these light shining through wall experiments. You take an optical cavity with a high power optical beam and put it in a magnetic field, and then you can generate axions if they exist, and these axions, of course, don't interact with matter, or almost not. And then in some cavity next to it, you would try to make the inverse process by have the axions couple to magnetic field again and go back to photons. And this is an ongoing experiment. But here the question is, can you do it without magnetic field? And so the statement here is that for some range of axions, the axions couple to circularly polarized light. And so the idea of these authors is that if you have for example a Michelson with arm cavities, and you can make it such that you have one right circularly polarized light in one arm and left polarized light in the other arm, then you can set upper limits on axions in this mass range, so where the mass is given by the lens. So this is very low masses. So we are talking about the audio range in terms of energy. So that is 10 to minus 12 eV or something like this. And so in order to preserve the circularity upon reflection, they have the nice idea to put lambda quarter plates into the cavities, and they always have the same kind of orientation of the signal as the beam traverses. And of course they realize that this might not be very practical in order to have very high powers.
What
and so on.
Causing the differential arm motion on a particle physics level as you think?
Yeah, so the point here is that you would use the axion, you don't generate axions, but you use the axions in the background if you see axions as a dark matter candidate.
Field.
Yeah, so you assume axions are the dark matter, mm-hmm. or some significant component of it. So we are swimming in a sea of these axions, and they so
you're looking for the modulation of the are you looking for something that's modulated by the motion of the Earth through the
Yeah, I thought so first, but I think what they claim is that you have the signal in the audio band because the two arms couple differently to the axion path. If you will.
Sorry, just what frequency is it? Is this a broadband thing? Is it a
Yeah, it's broadband if you do this trick with the lambda half plates in the cavity. But if you don't do that and just if you only would have circularly polarized light, then it would work only for just one mass, which is kind of resonant, like we discussed earlier. It's
right.
It's like a resonant detector, which would be only resonant for axion masses that correspond to round trip time or something like this. But they claim that you can put limits which are interesting in this 10 to minus 12 eV regime.
You know, these Yami Marsnap coatings that I have are already bioprinted.
Yeah.
I already have two cavities, and they have an anomalous mark.
Wonderful. Yeah. Okay, and something I found very funny, and I also don't know anything about, but which I just wanted to show you to finish, is a paper I only saw yesterday, which is only 6 days old, like published 7 June, probing axions with neutron star and spirals and other stellar processes, because we heard about axions and black holes. And one of the authors is from Perimeter Institute. Yun Wu Huang, I don't know, you know?
He was here yesterday.
Ah, okay. So, anyway, I just want to show you one sentence which I found exciting. So, in this paper, there's the idea that the axions, so axions could be produced by this super dense matter in the neutron stars, and in one scenario it says a more drastic effect occurs when the axion force is stronger than gravity and is repulsive. In this case, the neutron stars do not merge and instead come to rest at a fixed distance apart from each other. The waveform of the gravitational wave emitted in this case has features very different from a merger waveform. I found this very funny.
Yes. So. They just slow down at the end and they just they come together and they touch and they form just this.
Okay, yeah. That's all. Thank you.
That's a no violence kind of pacifist neutron star system.
So, Rana, what is your constraint on axions from the Cortina experiment?
I have to calculate this because we have, when the mirrors were assembled, because it was just done by a Caltech grad student. So the orientation of mirrors is somewhat randomized. And so probably like one is a quarter wave plate and the other one is effectively like eighth or something like that. But it's partially in this regime. But usually we try to get maximum interference. But if I understand this correctly, if you have two arms which are not perpendicular but parallel, you re-interfere the beams and I would make it cross-polarized so that normally I get no interference. And then the axion signals would once in a while give me some interference.
Like a null measurement. And then, yeah.
And then I would look at the time of the day, and when the Earth is spinning into the axion wind, I would look for excess of the nulls, and at the night time, we should be going away from the axion and the signal should get quiet. But if the interferometer is quiet at night time and noisy in the daytime, then that's a proof of axions.
Well, from this compensation system for mu splitter, what is the target cancellation factor on the lens?
It's not well modeled because we don't have a target power. Just I mean it would be nice if we have enough power to get to a linear regime where that would be kind of the goal, but there's no point in increasing the power for the sake of increasing the power, but it's at the level of the LIGO power, but I mean if we would get it linear, then that would be a great success, I think.
Any questions? If no more questions, let's thank Harvard again.